Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A reminder that we are Zooming on Thursday morning, but so much happened on Wednesday afternoon and Wednesday night that the show has changed dramatically just in the last 24 hours. Normally, we join Scott Braddock, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, the editor of the Quam Report, but literally at about 8:30 this morning, he said, Arnie, I can't do it. I can't do it. But of course, this is the home of Ted Cruz, so you can just imagine that he has a new assignment given what happened yesterday. I'm very grateful that we have Paul Glastras from the Washington Monthly to join us. Before we grab Paul, you know we begin with a political limerick. Skip Tenzer, our fabulous UNH professor who writes our limericks, has been prolific. He wrote four and sent them to me at 6 o'clock this morning. I'm actually going to read two of them and maybe read two at the end of this show. So hit it with the music, Dave.
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
He absolutely fomented violence by appealing to his unholy alliance with alt-right thugs and QAnon slugs to march on the Capitol in defiance. And one more by Skip Tenzer. They froze his social media accounts for the lies that he constantly flaunts. He caused death and mayhem with words as he made them, so they disabled his incendiary taunt.
People just liked it better that way.
So reach me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the worst?
Joining us right now, I got him at the last minute, and I had this funny feeling, Paul Glastras, both that you obviously, as the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, and you are based down in D.C., I had this feeling that you might have been on the street yesterday, sort of watching what was happening with the demonstrations. And sure enough, there's a piece at the Washington Monthly that we will actually post on my Facebook page entitled Notes from the Insurrection. Before the Capitol siege, I was at the protest and had the sense that anything could happen, but that probably nothing would. I was wrong. Paul Glastras, thank you so much for responding to my urgent call this morning. And I am so honored that you joined us and that you were there, because to have someone front and center is important. And also for you to still hang on to the fact that it couldn't be as bad as it got sort of tells us what we've been like for the last 4 years, somehow discounting his words, discounting his behavior, thinking it just can't get worse. And with each passing hour, Paul, it always did. It always did.
Well, I was on this show just, you know, within the last week, and you were saying you're worried about violence. We all knew the capacity for violence, but I was arguing, hey, we got through the election without violence. You know, maybe we'll get through this transition without violence. You know something is true, but when it doesn't happen, you begin to discount it, right?
Exactly. And I want people to know a little bit, just not only were the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, you wrote hundreds of speeches for President Clinton. You covered the Bosnian War. You actually wrote about the rise of the Michigan militia. You're not just some la-la who sort of walked into Washington and always sort of assumes that things will never get so bad. You've covered wars. You've covered the militia. This is important as we hear your words, because you are steeped in a real interesting bit of history and understanding of politics. And even Paul Glastras thought, well, it won't actually get that bad.
Yeah. Trump's election lit a fuse. I thought it would blow up early. And when it didn't blow up, I thought, all right, maybe we dodged the thing. But it was just a long fuse.
Yeah.
And it blew up yesterday. There's been some sporadic violence under this president. You know, some of it on the left, but a lot of it on the right. But it has mostly been on the fringes. There was, you know, the Kyle Rittenhouse shootings of Black Lives Matter protesters in Kenosha. There was Charlottesville. There was the Boogaloo members trying to foment race war in Las Vegas.
The governor of Michigan.
The attempt by the Michigan militia to kidnap. But most of it was either broken up, frankly, by the federal authorities or lone wolf stuff. And none of it could be directly tied to Donald Trump, even though, you know, we all knew and there was social media evidence that they were being motivated by the rhetoric of the president, but really nothing to tie it to him. Remember, people were concerned that when the Trump campaign was out there trying to recruit 50,000 poll watchers, that there was going to be violence at the polls. That didn't happen. The election went off, you know, largely without incident.
Now, can I push back on that? Because I think I know why. Because of the pandemic, you saw states around the country change their election procedure. You saw the governor of Texas extend early voting. You saw mail-in voting. What was normally a very sort of tight election where you kind of knew everything would happen on that Tuesday, instead it was almost a month of an election process.
I think that's right. I think procedures and the fact that everybody was looking for it, right, made it less likely. So, you know, it got the gap between our fears and the reality got so wide that it sparked a whole subgenre of Ross Douthat columns from the New York Times saying, oh, this president is too incompetent to pull off a proper coup. Well, you know, yesterday it happened.
So tell us a little bit about, you were on the streets, and even after you were down there with the demonstrators, you ended up going home. You didn't follow them as they went down to the Capitol. As you were talking to people, even then, you didn't get the assumption that this would turn into something as violent and as destructive as what we saw. What did they say as you were sort of just chatting with folks on the street?
I was more just taking their photos and videos, frankly, and listening. I really wasn't talking to them. But, you know, some of them were chanting, Biden cheated, Biden cheated. Others of them were literally chanting, let's go storm the Capitol. Honestly, this was like 60, 70% people, you know, over 50. Street violence tends to be a young person's game. And there were some young people there. I was at the Tea Party rallies. I've been at these right-wing rallies before. Everybody is nervous, and then nothing really happens. The mood was not so much menacing as sort of grimly determined. They just were marching there. It's a very heavily guarded place, the Capitol. So it's odd to me that they were able to breach through into the building. We're going to have to see how that was allowed to happen.
A couple of things. I've been around New Hampshire for a long time, and New Hampshire's a very libertarian state. We've had militia for a long time. You were covering the Michigan militia. Well, guess what? I knew the boys in the White Mountain militia because they would literally show up when I was doing a radio show. And I'll never forget. And so I knew about intimidation, but I also knew that they were all older white men. Okay. They were never 25-year-olds. They were never 30-year-olds. They were always 56. And they kind of incited each other. They would get each other more excited by their behavior. And so having been around them, I remember doing a show one day where I am literally covering the opening of a new mall. All right. And we had had a fight the week before about some gun issue on my radio talk show. All of a sudden, there I am at the mall at a big table with my microphone. And who shows up at the White Mountain Militia? And they start marching back and forth in front of me, trying to intimidate me. And what I proceeded to do was inform my audience exactly what they were doing. Okay, I let them know blow by blow what they were attempting to do to him. So I have seen it, but there becomes this kind of interesting group thing where you saw this, you know, Biden cheated or this was a stolen election. But there are enough people who think that they are revolutionaries. That's why they're armed. That's why they have shooting practice, because they know that eventually all that ammo under the bed and all those, you know, whatever the guns are that they have, that they will eventually use them. And Donald Trump, as you pointed out, was the long fuse, but he gave them time, opportunity, and a location and a raison d'etre. And I think that's what's so frightening, is that he did light that long fuse and they were armed and prepared. But this is the part that scares me. We always assume the Capitol Police know what they're doing. We always assume that the Washington, D.C. police know what they were doing. If Donald Trump has hollowed out the executive branch, what makes you think he hasn't also had the potential to hollow out some of the Capitol Police?
That's an interesting point. Let me just give you an interesting fact that I came upon yesterday. There is no question that Congress has been hollowed out because of GOP resistance. Congress is not invested in its own capacity, but that's not true of the Capitol Police. Over the last couple of decades, inflation-adjusted terms, the budget for the Congress overall has gone up 30%. It's gone up 330% for the Capitol Police.
Oh my God.
They are very well funded. So like I said, there's an oddness to this. Yeah. I don't know how it happened. We're going to find out. In some ways, I'm grateful that the police didn't mow down a bunch of protesters, right? You know, we had one woman die by a police shooting. On the other hand, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell could be in ICU right now because of the failure of the Capitol Police to do their basic job. So it's not a lack of resources. Something went wrong.
That statistic, write your next piece. Put that out there because people need to understand they have not been underfunded.
No.
As we know, Donald Trump has hollowed out the executive branch. We know there are lots of places where we also know that he seated some of his people within the executive branch that will be very hard for Joe Biden to remove. And what I think is really problematic, and you saw it with Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, you saw with 121 members of the House who continued even after this horrific event, which clearly felt like a coup or an attempt to overthrow the government. They still sided with that. And I have to ask the question, you can't have two masters. You can't choose Trump or choose the United States of America. And what we saw with those US senators and what we saw with those members of the House is that they made a choice and they sacrificed us in order to embrace and empower and basically justify the lies of Donald Trump. What do we do with them? That's what's so frightening, because even after Donald Trump leaves on the 20th, they're still around. And if they bought that and their allegiance is to him, they are not going to be useful for a country that needs to repair.
Nobody knows the answer to that, but recall the Michigan militia, recall the destruction of the Oklahoma Murrah federal office building. Recall the mood of the country just prior to that. This was the heyday of Newt Gingrich's anti-government. When that building was blown up and there were scores of people killed, civil servants, kids of civil servants in daycare, film of the Michigan militia, of which Timothy McVeigh was a kind of satellite member, came out. America was horrified. And that drained for a little while that really immensely building anti-government fervor. Right. I don't know what this incident yesterday, which I mean, the levels of meaning and surrealness are hard to count. But you saw that before the event, there were, I think, 11 senators who were siding with Josh Hawley. At least three of them after the event withdrew their objections. But only three, I think. The rest, as you say, proceeded with their protests, trying to argue, you know, that they were standing up for the Constitution. They use all the same language as the left uses about freedom, democracy. They, you know, torture it. That's the way they frame it for their base. You know, as you said, they're going to still be there. And the folks who stormed that Capitol are still going to be there. And their media supporters are going to be there, calling them, they already are, calling them patriots. We have a built-in culture of violence, a built-in culture of insurrection, a completely different vision of how to order the country and what democracy means. Just say, had several thousand Black Lives Matter protesters surrounded the Capitol and tried to breach the doors, I don't know that the Capitol Police would have been as restrained, let us just say.
I'm thinking of three things, which is why this is really problematic going forward. There are more guns and ammunition per person in the United States than any country in the world. Now, it's not like a lot of people have guns, but those that have it have arsenals, okay?
Right.
And we already know that you can do open carry in the New Hampshire legislature. A lot of states, Texas, I mean, it's just unbelievable. Not only are they allowed to have carried concealed, not only are they allowed to have open carry, they don't even need licenses to be carried concealed anymore in my state. So you know that this is a problem. It's not just a problem in Washington. It's a problem in potentially maybe 20 or 30 state capitals around the country. And again, we know that we have very lax laws. So we have an armed base, all right? We have an armed base that's allowed in public buildings with their ammunition. Now we have a situation, I'm going crazy about this, but I think this is really important. When you saw Mitt Romney and Mitch McConnell horrified by what they saw, I mean, Mitt at least has found his voice sooner than most of them, but Mitch McConnell now, and apparently his wife has now left as the Secretary of Transportation. She resigned last night. Well, which is so interesting that Mitch McConnell's wife, finally, Elaine Chao, has decided to leave as well. What frightens me is that because the Republicans control so many state legislatures, because we now have a Supreme Court that says partisan gerrymandering is constitutional, which blows my mind. We are now looking at a situation where we have ammunition, and now we have a gerrymandering situation where the crazies that Donald Trump still controls are going to control the Republican Party for the next decade if they're allowed to do the partisan gerrymandering that I know that they want to do. What is going to be fascinating for me is to see whether there are going to be enough Republicans still left in legislatures around the country that will suddenly side with the Democrats in their House and ask for independent redistricting. Because if they're going to save their country, they can't do partisan gerrymandering because it will feed Trump and feed the destruction of democracy. And if we can get the Mitch McConnells and the Romneys to be able to go to some of those Republicans in those state legislatures and say, join the Democrats, not for a Democratic redistricting, but for a more fair and balanced redistricting that won't follow a gerrymandered situation, you will not only do good things for your constituents, but you will actually even maybe save your party. I may be in la-la land, but that's what frightens me, is the gerrymandering and the ammunition and the Trump. And that's a trifecta for future failure.
Well, you know, from your lips to God's ear, I don't see it. I think the concern you have is real. Democrats had high hopes to flip state legislatures, as you said on the show last week. It went the other way, if anything. The only two legislatures that flipped were in New Hampshire, and they were both went Democrat to Republican. I think that tells us that Democrats have to think about a different way. They need a different argument than the one they've been making year after year, you know, for a couple of decades, because it's not getting through to the people that the Democrats need in the key states to shrink the Republican Party down to a non-powerful, inert party. Because in the history of this country, it is very rare that we have a period like now where for decades, the two parties have been at 50-50 and are fighting trench warfare. And it's that equality of power and that capacity every cycle to flip control of the government that is part of why politics is so profoundly negative right now. In most times in American history, there has been one dominant party. There will be a dominant party again in this country. I don't know when, and I don't know which party, but that's the titanic battle that we're in. And either the Republicans figure out how to shatter the Democratic coalition, or the Democrats figure out how to shatter the Republican coalition. And if you're in favor of small d democracy, I think you want the latter.
We learned a lot from Georgia. I haven't talked to you since what happened in Georgia, which was just, I mean, I was in tears. I was just so excited. But there's a lesson from Georgia, and there's a lesson from Stacey Abrams. And it's kind of the lesson that I tried to share with my Democratic Party in 92 and 96, but I got blown off. Elections aren't about an election. It is a perpetual, consistent feeding of the base, explaining to them what you're doing, getting them to understand the consequences of elections, making them understand why policy matters to them, and that it doesn't just take place 2 or 3 months before a primary or 2 or 3 months before an election. It is a constant, constant massaging and conversation. I was a fellow at Harvard, and I took over Bella Abzug's office. And Bella had a great quote, "You have to lose, lose, lose to win." And what she meant was, you look at a loss and go, okay, we're done. And what she said was, no, learn from the loss. Build on the loss. Figure out what you did wrong. Go back again. Every loss of an election is not an ending. It's an instruction sheet. It teaches you what to do. My party sucks at that. My party assumes that, frankly, everything happens at the presidential level. No, it doesn't. Because if you keep Biden and Kamala alone, they will not survive. And what I said to people, and Paul, this is something important. You saw demonstrations in 50 state capitals. A lot of state capitals had demonstrations similar to what you saw in Washington, not as destructive, but there were little sort of pockets of unrest all over the place because they couldn't get to Washington, so they thought they would go to Austin. They couldn't get to Washington, so they thought they would go to Concord. I am saying to people, well, then I want my governor, Republican or Democrat, to stand up to those people. But then we need to support them in standing up. Don't ask them to stand up alone. Stand up with them. And I think that's the other message here, is that elections don't just happen around election time. They're literally an everyday event because you have to feed and explain to people who you are and what you're doing. So by the time the election happens, they understand and they know their job.
I could not agree with you more. We all remember Howard Dean and his 50-state strategy and how a lot of people that I know and admire poo-pooed it, but it was exactly the right strategy. Not only was there Stacey Abrams, you know, in Georgia, you know, but John Ossoff himself, right, built an immense grassroots machine. John Ossoff being the Democrat who beat David Perdue in the runoff in Georgia 2 days ago, literally flipping the Senate. Decades ago, when the labor movement was large, one of the things that the labor movement did was inform its members about what's happening in terms of policy for the working person and gave them a community in which to identify and leaders whose views on politics and policy they trusted because they felt they had their backs. And so, you know, the Democrats had that machine. Remember, not labor often sided with Republicans, but on balance, it sided with Democrats. That machine was specifically attacked and shrunk by the Republican Party.
On purpose, because they
on
knew.
On purpose, yeah. Right? The whole world of blogging, of which the Washington Monthly was an early participant, was an attempt by average people to take back the job from the press of instructing people on the left about what was happening. And it created a conversation and a movement that was then crushed, right, by Google and Facebook because they took over that job. And now the Russians and the Koch brothers run it. So we desperately need, you know, I deal with a lot of funders because the Washington Monthly has to survive. It's a nonprofit. And one of my greatest frustrations over the years is funders putting money in years when there are elections, presidential elections, you know, going to Palm Springs for the next 2 years and not wanting to be involved. And I understand it on a personal level. It is absolutely one of the problems of the Democratic Party and the left that the funding is, you know, spiky and not consistent. And there are plenty of studies to show that on the right, the funding for the think tanks, for the advocacy groups is steady, steady, steady. So we have not yet learned that lesson on the left.
I remember listening to Ralph Reed in 1990 with the Moral Majority. And he said, in 10 years, we will take over the Republican Party. It took him 8.
Yeah.
But guess what? He understood the constant battle and what he needed to do and how he built on whatever. Not that I'm the only one that does this, but I'm going to explain why did AOC win? AOC won because the person that she replaced hadn't come home for a long time. And somehow he just thought because he'd been around forever that they would just sort of a knee-jerk reaction and keep him as a member of Congress. Well, she pointed out he hadn't come home. Well, you know what? That's what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to just be in Washington and say, oh, that's my job. Your job is to be with your constituents, to have an ear with your constituents, to understand them. That is a message that we need to teach sort of future elected officials. It isn't good enough to stay in Concord or stay in DC or stay in Austin. It has to be that you're constantly going out, hearing them, talking to them, and letting them know that you see and understand their lives. And then guess what? That's how trust gets restored. I had a friend who was one of the most conservative Republicans in the country. He was from North Carolina, long story. And when he was running for Congress and knew that he was going to absolutely win because there was no question he was, his name was Robin Hayes. You will know who he is. But I've known Robin for 30 years. Robin said, what should I do, Arnie? I know I'm going to win the election. I said, I know what you should do, Robin. You should go to a couple of school board meetings. You should go to a couple of selectman meetings and city council meetings. Go by yourself and sit in the back of the room and just listen. I said, you're not there because you need them. You're there because you need to hear them. They will be shocked that you are there, knowing that you're going to win. You're going to be the next congressman. You're a multimillionaire, but you're there to listen. He said, that's a great idea. But I'm telling that to an uber conservative Republican congressman. How come no Democrat ever asked me the same question? What should I do? Paul Glastras wrote a piece, Notes from the Insurrection. Before the Capitol siege, I was at the protest and had the sense that anything could happen, but that probably nothing would. I was wrong. The editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, Paul Glastras, thank you so much for doing this at the last minute, and thank you for being part of the show.
What a pleasure. Thank you, Arnie.
All right, everyone. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back with Bill Curry.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. Hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, and it's useful in applications such as oil refining and fertilizer production. It can even be burned to produce electricity and power vehicles. On Earth, hydrogen is bound up in molecules such as those found in natural gas, so it must be extracted before it can be used. But producing it from natural gas is an energy-intensive process that emits carbon dioxide and contributes to global warming. Huan Din of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory says there's a cleaner way to create hydrogen gas, using H2O.
You just start with water. You use electricity to split it, and you make hydrogen and oxygen. You don't have any pollutants of any kind.
And the electricity can be produced by renewable sources of energy. Hydrogen produced this way is called green hydrogen. It's still too expensive to compete in the mass market, but the technology is advancing. Din leads a consortium of 6 national labs researching ways to make it. And market researchers predict that green hydrogen could compete on price with conventionally produced hydrogen within 10 years.
I'm very, very excited.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder that we are Zooming our show on Thursday morning, and so much has happened on Wednesday night that we probably can be talking about this for the next couple of days until January 20th, if not in the next 4 years. Before I grab our regular Friday guest, Bill Curry, I want to read one more limerick by Skip Tenzer, our fabulous political verse writer, because he's my quote-unquote deadline poet. He sent me 4 limericks this morning because he has been out of his mind. I read 2 to start the show, but I'm going to read one more before Bill joins us. Here is Skip's limerick. He's a leader with constant resentment who promotes dangerous discontentment. After all, he's combusted. He can never be trusted. It's time to invoke the 25th Amendment. Wow. Joining us as he does every Friday is Bill Curry. Bill Curry ran for the governorship of Connecticut twice. He was involved with the nuclear freeze movement. He wrote speeches for Bill Clinton, was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He's written for Salon.com. He is one of our most loved progressive talkers on this show. And everyone always says, get him on every day. And I said, no, it's my show. Anyway, let me welcome Bill Curry to the program. And Bill, nobody could take their eyes off the TV set yesterday. Nobody could stop listening into the wee hours of the night, because after they tried to shut down the halls of Congress, and clearly people were skirting under their desks and bombarding them, seeing them bombard the halls of Congress and smashing windows, I kept saying, don't let them stop you. As soon as they somehow get these people out of the building, get back to the work of what you were assigned to do, which is basically to count the electoral votes and to certify this election. Don't let them stop you. The good news is they didn't. And they actually went through until the wee hours of the night and they accomplished their task. So I now am here to accomplish my task, which is to ask you about your thoughts from yesterday, what you are seeing using the term fascism, but more importantly, give me some idea of how we move into a future that seems so dark as we approach this show today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, as always. Good to be in your company. The world is dark today because the dust and smoke of yesterday has yet to lift. Yeah. It is not dark today because the future is dark. I believe, as odd as it may sound to hear this, and as odd as it feels to say it, that there were many unintended gifts in yesterday's carnage and chaos. Among them, we were losing the fight over police reform on a national basis. That reversed field yesterday in so many ways, but people saw in bas relief the difference between how the police handle a Black protest and how they handle a white protest. What a horrible job they did preparing for, responding to, etc. It just opened it back up.
As shocking as it may be, there were actually some gifts from yesterday.
As someone said yesterday, that January 6th will join December 7th, 1941, and September 11th, 2001, as one of the 3 great days marked in infamy in American history. I think that's right. It was horrendous and traumatizing. It reminds me that some of what we've lost under Trump will not be retrieved in my lifetime. Beginning with America's reputation in the world, it will never be what it was. Anyone who calls the President of the United States the leader of the free world in the next few years should only do it tongue in cheek. For a number of years, the leader of the free world has been Angela Merkel. And it's kind of like after Johnny Carson, no one got to be the king of late night.
Yeah, exactly.
The circumstances have changed. It's not because David Letterman wasn't as funny, but it was a different world. It's a different world now. It's not a world in which one country is the guarantor of the world's safety. It's a world in which everybody but us understands that building multilateral institutions, reforming the UN, the WTO, the IMF, the World Bank, creating nonviolent conflict resolution mechanisms and multilateral conflict resolution mechanisms where violence is necessary as well, to change all that institutionally, not just rebuild our relationships with NATO, okay? That's not what's on the table now here. So many things have changed in such deeply systemic ways that weren't about to. So this day will live in infamy, but it's changed discussions so deeply. And it's really 2 days. It's Tuesday and Wednesday. The Georgia results that shot the first arrow across the bow of the Republican Party. The Republican Party that wasn't planning on changing even after losing Trump, because they picked up seats in the House and held the Senate, seemingly. That was the first thing. And then yesterday's circumstances were overwhelming. Police reform is back on the table, for sure. Most of Biden's proposed agenda is back on the table. The word fascist, I've been talking about this, I wrote a piece about this in Salon. We keep using words for Trump and Trumpism. First of all, one of the words we use is Trumpism. It's a terrible word. There wasn't such a thing as Mussoliniism. There was fascism, and Mussolini was the icon. And in this case, we've had genuine historic fascism staring us in the face for 5 years now. And we've refused to call it by its rightful name. We call it populist, as if Donald Trump had something in common with William Jennings Bryan and Walter Reuther. We call it authoritarian, which is inadequate. We call it conservative or Republican, which is ridiculous. You can call it reactionary, but so many people are reactionary who don't espouse direct violence, who don't peddle conspiracy theories. You can be a reactionary without being a QAnon purveyor. You only get to this, the mass deceitful propaganda, the conspiracy theories, the oppression of minorities, the incitations to violence, the fascination with military regalia, the cultish following of a leader, every single aspect of fascism. Again, I wrote about this a couple of years ago now in Salon. This morning in the New York Times, the Washington Post, I saw three references. I saw the word fascist appear three times, finally. It reminded me of when the New York Times finally used the word liar after Trump was elected. After the election, we called him a liar for the first time in a major publication. Believe it or not, it took that long. Today, the word fascism is finally becoming current. It's an important word. One, I say this as a lover of language. It's the most accurate word. It's the only label for which he checks all the boxes. And so we deserve the truth when we refuse to use it out of our concern, I guess, for someone's tender sensibilities or because some journalist schooled in the ideology of even-handedness doesn't want to drink from that cup. We've cost ourselves a riot in the Capitol yesterday for not calling these fascists out, including Trump, a long time ago for exactly what they are. That's changing now. The truth had its best day in a long time yesterday because the whole country woke up and realized that lying leads to violence, that the truth is every bit as much a foundation of democracy as the right to vote. That it is indispensable, that it must be defended, that you can't just let thousands of lies go unrebutted, as all the Republicans and even so much the media did. All that, it's 2 days that changed the world. It really, really is. I do think that from police reform to international relations to the entire progressive agenda, at least as it's reflected in the agenda of Joseph Biden, raising the minimum wage and getting a public option and fighting climate change, everything's back on the table. And the civil war the Republicans weren't going to have is now back on the table. They're about to have it for sure.
Right.
Some of them know that they have to walk away from this now. Yeah. 3 days ago, before Georgia and before the Trump mob, very few of them knew it. None of them would say it, except Mitt Romney. God bless his errant soul. And now they all do. And the confidence of the Republican Party has been shaken to its foundations. And so that even part of Biden's dream of bipartisanship, there'll be a few times in the next year where that's going to work. It's not enough to get where we want to go, but it's going to work.
As you were talking about, this is what happens with lies. That what you saw happening at the Capitol is really a culmination of 5 years of lies and hatred that's been massaged and basically, to some extent, also covered as if it was the facts by Fox News and whatever. But this is what you get. The culmination of all these lies produced the result that we saw at the Capitol the other day. I remember running for governor. On my stationery, it said, Bill, political candidates have a choice. They can either pander to people's fears in an effort to win or speak the truth in order to lead. And one of the things you hear from Joe Biden is, I will always tell you the truth. Now, what he's going to have to be able to remind people is sometimes you're not going to like to hear it. Sometimes it's painful. The beauty of lies is that it's mythology, that you give people, you feed to people what they want to hear, not what the truth is. And ultimately, what they want to hear is what ultimately led to what happened, just yesterday. No, they wanted to believe that this was stolen. They wanted to believe Donald Trump. Well, what they ended up getting was this incredibly destructive thing to democracy. So I see that it's important. And I also do think that now you have a group of Republicans who not only understand that there's nothing left of their party, or if they're going to regain their party, they're going to have to find their spine. But you heard that there was a bomb at the RNC headquarters. Did you hear this? They found a bomb. They found a bomb at the RNC headquarters. You see, these people are not Republicans. This is not about a party. They don't believe in the GOP. And I think that placing a bomb at the RNC headquarters is a perfect testament to who they are and what they believe, which also, in a way, liberates those people that still consider themselves Republicans, like Mitch McConnell and like Mitt Romney. I mean, that's where they placed the bomb, not at the DNC that we know of, but at the RNC. What does that say to you?
At the same time, I also, though, recognize that many Republicans who recognize, as I do, that these sentiments, if not quite their radical expression, as seen yesterday, but these same sentiments are the core of the most solid base of that party. Now, again, a lot's on the, back on the table. A lot of these people are going to go back to their gun clubs. Sorry, guys, the hunters, but there's a whole milieu out there of people. A lot of them are going to go back to their paramilitary survivalist Ruby Ridge crowd activities. They're not going to leave the country, but they're going to leave politics. They're going to leave electoral politics. Some of them are. You could see that starting to happen in Georgia, even in the midst of all of this. It started to happen in Georgia when Trump is gone. And after what happened yesterday, that's going to accelerate, I believe. The Republicans, the lesson they will take is the lesson that Rance Priebus took from 2012. That will now become party orthodoxy, that their future lies in courting votes of minorities, that they must increase their Latino and Black vote. And to do that, they'll have to change. I don't know how exactly, but they'll have to become somewhat better than they are. You can't court minorities and peddle quite so much fascism. The only road they have, I've said it here many times in other places, but it's not just the browning of our population. It's the fact that 4.5 million people turn 18 every year in this country. There are 20 million young people coming on board between now and the next presidential election, and they will make the biggest difference. They hate Trump, you know, 2/3 of them. He does worse among young people than he does among Hispanics. And so they're going to be changing. And that if they change in good ways, I'm happy to have a healthy conservative party to be fighting this stuff out with. That would be great. They're a long way from it. They're a long, long way from it. And so this is an opportunity. Biden, what a wonderful irony it would be. I think Biden has a chance to be one of the great presidents in American history right now. I really do. I don't think he's one of the most prodigious figures in American history, far from it. He has the chance, though. If he has one of the greatest presidencies, that makes him one of the greatest presidents. And I was thinking this morning what a delicious irony it would be if Trump had to live to see Biden put on Mount Rushmore. I'm for it. I'm officially for it right now. If he just passes a living wage and a strong public option, I'm for the Biden on Mount Rushmore committee. If Trump dies, I might not care as much. But there's so much opportunity here. There was, even if we didn't win these two seats, there was more of an opportunity than our people worried. But with the two seats in the Senate and this tableau and a broken, divided, bitter, and recriminatory Republican Party, there hasn't been this much opportunity to do this much good in a long time. Everything they are was laid out in a terrifying tableau for an entire day. What they represent was repeated on television over and over on every station for 24 hours in a day that no one will forget. Their reputation will never be the same. It will never be the same. And now the question is whether we can take advantage of it and start solving people's problems.
I actually agree with you. And what you just said this morning is something I thought about last night, kind of like a light bulb moment. As grieving as I was and as appalled as I was not surprised. I was absolutely not surprised. I've been predicting it. My producers will tell you how often I've been predicting this. What I thought was also interesting, and this is something that we also have to talk about, there is no question that the business community has had a huge influence on politics in America. They hire all the lobbyists. They get all the corporate cuts. They get everything. But there was something that came out yesterday that I thought was absolutely fascinating. It was this just in, it happened yesterday afternoon. The National Association of Manufacturers, a generally pro-Republican group, called on Vice President Pence to call a cabinet meeting to invoke the 25th Amendment. Now, I saw that tweet and I'm like, what? And so another thing that also is an opportunity is not only have we seen this incredibly broken Republican Party, not only do we see what's happened to our healthcare system because of the pandemic, what's happened to our economy because of the pandemic, the fact that these frontline workers have never been paid like frontline workers and we have to raise the minimum wage. And you've heard me say this over and over again, Joe Biden leads from behind. But what is now in front of him, as you point out, creates such incredible opportunity to repair so much, Bill, that not only could he be a great president, but here's something that Pew Research told me just yesterday. Even though we are the most divided as a country, even though we don't trust each other on values, even though we don't trust each other on politics, when they ask the question, what do you expect of the next president of the United States? Between 70 and 75% of the respondents said, we want him to be a president for all the people. Even as they come in with the partisan divide and the hatred, they don't want to see that coming out of their president. They want something more. And that, again, reinforces the opportunity for Joe Biden.
There's no question it's there. It's all in our hands now. Even though the House and the Senate are so closely divided, about as close as you can get in both, we have so much more power than that right now. And the one thing about power is that it is A, informal, and B, evanescent. We'll have to take maximum advantage of it merely to retain it. It is a constant of the Christian idea that giving is receiving. The more you spend it, actually, the more of it you have, as long as you spend it wisely. We have this opportunity that is just enormous. To what you were just talking about, let me just say that I think it's also very much on point. Let all progressives vow here and now to be as honest with ourselves as the National Association of Manufacturers just was with its constituency.
Thank you.
They just took a really big chance and told a lot of their members something that they didn't especially want to hear. Even if they agreed with it, they didn't want it spoken out loud. And they went out and did something extremely patriotic, extremely patriotic. I hope no one loses his job for it, but I agree with you. It was the highlight of my day. At the same time, I want to say that my friend Tom Frank, who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, did a piece in Harper's last year saying that I was emerging as one of my party's fiercest critics. My own party, it didn't happen very often. I was very proud of that, and I always have been. I've always been asking my party to change. I've always felt that the only worthwhile debate is the one that goes on within the Democratic Party. If we fix our own problems, we'll be able to fix other people's problems, which is the whole point of being here. But that also means right now, making sure that we stop to take full advantage of it. It doesn't mean that people want our entire agenda as it exists. Here's the really good news. Not only do we not have to negotiate with Donald Trump or Mitch McConnell or their activist base, we only have to negotiate with Joe Manchin. Now, he's not my favorite senator, okay? But he already votes my way 2/3 of the time. If we can't sit down within our party and talk to the Sinemas and Manchin and outflank them often by mustering public opinion, also outflank them by getting the most important core objectives achieved while meeting people's legitimate concerns, answering their legitimate questions, this is our chance. And we're going to have to do exactly, you heard speech after speech. Mitt Romney was brilliant yesterday. The way to respect those voters is to tell them the truth. That brought a tear to my eye. Mitt Romney brought a tear to my eye yesterday. National Association of Manufacturers and Mitt Romney had me crying. But now we have to do that. This is our moment to turn and say, what are the compromises we make? I don't want anybody to compromise on living wage. I think we can get $15 and an inflation mechanism, get all the lost purchasing power of the minimum wage back, and ensure that this never happens to us again, where it loses all its value. We could do that. I don't want to compromise one bit on the public option. 70% of the people of West Virginia already want it, Joe Manchin.
Thank you.
So we just have to mobilize. We have to make sure we write it correctly. But we're not going to be able to eliminate all the student debt. And we are trillions of dollars more in debt today than when this was proposed a year ago. We've had added trillions and trillions of dollars to our debt. We're going to have to make some fiscal choices. I want to make sure we get childcare, and I want to get rid of the student debt for everybody under 75, maybe even 100,000. I want to get rid of it for the middle class and for the working poor and the poor. But I want to at least accommodate the views of the rest of our potential majoritarian coalition. And I also want to recognize that of the $7 trillion on the table in our proposals, if we get half of them, if we got childcare and significant student debt relief, and we got a real climate change agenda through, we've had a lot of dreams come true. I don't want to fight over a Green New Deal. I don't want to fight over the label. If we get a $1 trillion infrastructure bill that we even call a green infrastructure bill, it'll have most of those jobs in it. And they're lasting jobs in the solar industry. They're jobs that people from the old manufacturing sector can get and earn 30, 40 bucks an hour as this industry gets established and have real lives and families. We've got what we want on the table in front of us. If we have the courage and the brains to trim our own sails a little bit as we walk into this and to walk in with humility and respect, if we know that we should fight for our values to the end, but for our opinions, not quite so hard, okay? If we can just figure that out walking in, man, this could be so much of what I've dreamed of since I came to conscious awareness of the world in which I lived in. That's how much is on the table now. I'm not predicting we're going to get all that. We're the Democrats. We'll probably screw it up. But this is all on the table. And out of all the horror and violence and tragedy of what happened yesterday, out of those ashes arises this phoenix. I am thrilled at that realization this morning.
I know you haven't written for Solange for a while, but you need to write the idea that the National Association of Manufacturers and Mitt Romney made you cry. Because
it did.
No, it made me cry too. And when you said that, I started to smile because I was crying too. That is both an olive branch, a recognition of courage. It's also saying that it doesn't have to be just my people that I can acknowledge do good things and right things. I think we need to be able to see the goodness in others. And that's the other thing that I think was valuable. What Mitt Romney did was very, very powerful. He's been alone for a long time. I don't want him to become a Democrat. I am grateful that he is a Republican. I hope he can repair his Republican Party. But what you saw was someone who was willing to speak the truth, that's our common ground. You know, that is the Velcro that can hold us together as a nation, is if we follow that truth.
Amen. I bet there's not a single issue in which I see completely eye to eye with Mitt Romney. But you can ask Ted Kennedy, if he were still here, what it was like to negotiate with Mitt Romney over healthcare in Massachusetts. Ted played a big role in the Massachusetts legislative efforts. Or ask those Democratic legislatures. And our ability now to get to a point where we ourselves have a sustainable majority and the opposition is more like Mitt Romney than Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
Because of the dire straits in which Republicans find themselves in. Somebody once said that we tend to grow from pain rather than virtue. I know it's been true in my own life.
Bill Curry joins us every Friday for The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Socially distance, wear a mask, stay safe, and be vigilant in order to keep this democracy. It is not something that you just show up on occasion. It is something you do every day. All right, everyone. We'll see you next week. Ciao. You better-